Steve, thanks so much. Hi, everybody. It's Bill and Wendy. Welcome to the show. Should be a good show. We'll learn a little bit about twins later on.
You have twins.
I do have twins.
I always wanted to be a twin because one of me is not enough.
Oh, is that true? That is the truer words never spoken. Dane Neal will be by also to talk about food. But first, very, very quickly, Steve, as long as we've got you and you're awake.
What is going on?
More tickets are now available for this trip to Prague. Can this be true?
You know, we had the demand has been so great, and we kept going back and trying to get more tickets. And we had a third group, and each group is its own, so it's not like it's a monster number of people. But we got 40 more tickets. I had a waiting list of about 25 people, so there are about 10 or 15 spots still open,
So this guarantees you airfare to and from, it guarantees you a beautiful place to stay, and you will also get tickets to the Blackhawks opener.
Yeah, like a VIP area for the Blackhawks game in three days, I think it's a five-day trip, so 3 days in Prague.
That's excellent.
Too.
Are you thinking about going?
I would love to go.
Bill.
I would love to go.
Why don't you go?
I got a guy.
You know somebody?
I can get you, I could set you up.
I think it would be so much fun not only to be there, but to see the Blackhawks play on foreign ice. I was going to say soil, but the game will be slowed down considerably if they're playing on soil. So you're saying, Steve, that they will play it also on ice while in Prague.
And it's indoors, so you'll be all set there.
Something for everyone. All right. Boy, would that be fun.
Now, they're doing this to get the excitement of hockey all over the world, correct?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if that's the case. It's pretty exciting already in the Czech Republic, you know.
But most sports have done this program now where they'll play a football game, a basketball game, a hockey game overseas to what they call grow the game, to make people, I mean, people in Prague already know that the NHL exists and that hockey's a great sport, but, you know, to get the fervor of it happening live right there.
Well, you know, maybe it's not to make them hockey fans, but it's to make them NHL fans.
Oh, yeah.
To where they'll pay to watch the games, they'll pay to wear the Blackhawks sweaters and things like that.
I'll tell you, there is nothing like being live at a game. I mean, watching it on TV is exciting.
Sure.
Now that we have a TV where I can see the puck. But being at a game, just experiencing that really will create the love.
Right.
It really will.
Yeah. Right.
How exciting.
Yeah.
So,
and
Bill,
Steve, you don't get to go on this?
I'm not going on this one. Steve Cochran's going. Again, there are three trips, so Steve's going to be in one of the groups.
Oh, okay.
Somebody suggested, Bill, maybe your best friend Grant Mulvey can hook you up.
Wouldn't that be fun?
Grant's on the trip.
Well, then you should go with Grant.
That would be so much fun.
And his wife. That wouldn't be too awkward.
No, that'd be fine. why is that awkward? That's fine.
My girl, Bill.
Yeah. That's what it would be. Oh, well, all right. So for anybody thinking about this, Steve, if you're considering it, they want to call you, correct?
They can call me at 847-606-6065 or send me an email. It's at stevebertrandtravel.com. You can find the details up on wgnradio.com, too.
All right. Very, very nice. I will preface this by saying that I know that anytime we talk about the President of the United States, people get immediately angry. You don't even have to, like what I just said there while prefacing
texts
this.
Texts are coming in
people
already.
People are already angry.
And shut up, Bill.
I know. What about Hillary? I didn't say anything yet.
Hey, Hillary is not involved in anything right now.
Right. All right.
What's going on? That's what I'm talking about, what's going on.
I tried to figure this out with Steve this morning. Steve, evidently, the New York Times.
The Smath.
Has said that they have obtained a leak by which Donald Trump would have been, of all U.S. citizens, the person claiming the most losses, correct?
Of high-income citizens, they think that no one has lost more money, had lost more money. I think it's in one particular decade, right?
Right.
And obviously that's why he did not want his tax returns released.
Well, they say that that's one of the reasons.
Because no one likes to admit a loss, really.
Well, especially somebody who wrote a book about sealing the art of the deal is about sealing multi-million dollar, if not billion dollar deals.
And that book came out just at the end of this decade we're talking about.
Right.
And everybody who supports him said, well, God, he is such a great businessman.
Right.
What better person to run our country?
He ran on the platform of, if there's one thing I know about, it's making great business deals. But how could that be the same guy that lost more money than anybody else in the country?
Although if you put more into it and take more risks, you, of course, he'll lose more than I will because I didn't put anything out there.
Well,
I get that, too.
The beauty is, too, is you can lose other people's money.
Yes.
You get people to give you money to invest, and then you lose it, and you can continue to fly around on your own jet.
Yes. Now, I will play devil's advocate for a second, Steve, and ask you this. He maintains that it's not true, He says that the New York Times is once again providing false news, fake news, as he calls
it. Well, no, he defended it first and then said this is fake news. Why even defend it then?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. Steve, you can field that. But my question is, what do we do with this information? Like almost everything else revolving around Donald Trump, what happens as a result of it? Let's say it's true. Let's say it's not true. What do we do with this information?
There is so much information about the president and his administration that none of it really sticks anymore. It's like being in a rainstorm and claiming to be, you know, hit by one drop.
Yeah.
Any one drop now doesn't really have much of an impact because there are so many of them. And I really think that works to the president's favor because things will come out now that could be crippling for other administrations. But it's like, well, it doesn't, you know, here comes another thing. And people tend to just sort of dismiss it.
If you're a Trump fan, though, and you find out that he did lose all this money, does that change your mind?
Nope, I don't think so.
Should it?
I think we naturally are very defensive about our decisions.
Yeah.
You know, whether you're a Hillary person or, you know, a Bernie person. And so it takes a lot for you to admit that you might have been wrong about a person. And I think that at this point, if you're a diehard Trump person, with the amount of things that have come out, I don't think anything else is going to come out to change your mind.
But with the way the taxes are structured, so he went years without having to pay any federal income tax, right?
Right. I think they said 8 of 10, yeah, maybe, or something, right, like that.
All right. So does he cop to that? Is he admitting to that part of it, or is he not commenting on that end of it?
Well, I think he said during the campaign about how he had great tax lawyers and he didn't pay any more taxes than he needed to, which is exactly right. I don't either.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think a big part of the story also is not about individual Donald Trump, but it's about how the tax laws favor big-time real estate,
yeah,
investors.
Yeah.
You know, that they can do this and bring in, you know, millions and millions of dollars and claim a loss and not pay taxes.
And 630 says tax loss is not real loss. Tax loss means he's great at manipulating the tax code.
That's my point.
Yep.
And
he worked the system.
The Massachusetts senator running for president, her name has escaped me now, Elizabeth Warren.
Oh, okay.
She's out with a tax plan where, and this is not completely related, but she wants industry, corporations to pay taxes on the income they report to their shareholders,
okay,
not that they report to the IRS. In other words, you know, a company like Amazon paid no income tax. They presumably made money, but they presented that to their stockholders. But when it comes to filing taxes, they can use loopholes and things like that,
wow,
to report an actual loss.
Wow.
Or defer things. I mean, you know, and look, they're just taking advantage of what is on the books for them. And I do too. You know, I take every deduction I possibly can.
So at what point does America say, why this double standard? I can't speak for everybody, but I got crunched in taxes this year.
Yeah.
In other years, there have been other years that have been okay. There have been years that have not been okay. But this past year, when we finished with our taxes, we owed way more than I've ever owed. And I didn't make any more money than I'm used to making, but I owed a lot more money. So at what point does the average American who says, hey, I'm getting crunched in taxes, but here's a guy who says he's worth this much money, but he went years without paying any taxes. What does that say to people?
Well, it's hard because, I mean, I could say you could vote for Elizabeth Warren if that's your issue. And, you know, you might be able to bring in a president who's committed to that. But then you have to face the Congress. And the fact is, look, the big money people get big money breaks because they contribute and they have big money.
Yeah.
So it's not.
But won't that seep in, Steve, where people will say, I get that, but that's kind of not fair. At what point do we just take a look at and though we have to restructure this to some extent?
It's one thing for you to say it's not fair. It's another thing for the chairman of the banking committee in the Senate to say it's not fair and to try to change it. And those are the people, I don't know about this particular chairman, but the people who are making the votes are the people who, you know, are likely benefiting from contributions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can we take a break and come,
yeah,
back with some phone calls and,
yeah,
texts about,
please,
this?
Please. We're at 312-981-7200. We'd love to hear from you. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. All right, it's us. It's Bill and Wendy. As I mentioned earlier, I know as soon as we pull out politics, as soon as we mention Donald Trump's name, people get furious. All I'm saying is this. I'm trying my best to make sense of the fact that a guy who wrote a book called The Art of the Deal and ran for president based on the fact that he was an amazing deal maker and a cash cow, lost all this money, lost more money, they said, than any other person in the United States. That's a lot.
That hurts, too.
That hurts.
That is why you don't want that information to come out.
Yeah, I guess.
You want to be on the top of the list, but not that list.
All right, several callers coming to answer some questions for us.
Mary, you can give us some insight because are you an accountant?
Yes.
All right.
Yes, I am.
So you prepare income tax. What do we need to know that will make more sense of this?
Well, I think there's a lot that can be learned from looking at an individual's income tax return. I prepare income tax returns for clients that don't make quite as much or high profile as Mr. Trump. I'm not a fan of his, and according to the law right now, he wasn't required to produce his income tax returns, and I'm thinking, what is he hiding? Because he clearly, you have to disclose foreign investments. You have to disclose foreign bank accounts. So even if he didn't pay any income taxes, if you have legitimate business losses, those can be carried forward to offset future gains. But we need to know if he is, and we would know from his tax returns whether he was had foreign interest out that he would be profiting from in his role as President of the United States.
Mary, one of the things that has come up over the last couple of years where we have not seen his income taxes was the belief that he probably had some business dealings with foreign countries that could be detrimental to the United States, for instance, Russia. Is this information that we've got from the New York Times better or worse for him, that he lost as much money as he allegedly lost as much money? Is that better news for Donald Trump or not as good as having business dealings with foreign powers like Russia?
I mean, I don't know. Nothing seems to stick to him.
Yeah.
Think of any other president having this kind of situation they've all revealed their tax returns. And you know, what if President Obama or President H.W. Bush or George W. Bush told the Attorney General not to appear before Congress?
Mary, I have one more question. If you don't know the answer, I'm fine with that. Just tell me you don't know the answer. But all along, whenever anybody suggests that he reveal his taxes, he says he's under audit, he can't do it. But people say, no, people do that all the time when they're under audit. What's the truth on that?
I do not know that. The IRS said that he would still be able to show his income tax returns if he wants.
All right.
So...
Okay.
No.
All right.
Mary, Teflon.
Yeah.
Teflon Don. That's
Thank
what
you.
I like to call him. Thank you, Mary.
Uh-huh.
We appreciate that. Kevin has a quick comment. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, the thing that gets me is that they're looking at tax returns that are 30 years old with today's goggles. Now, if you think back, you know, he invested heavily in the USFL. That went under. He invested heavily in Atlantic Casinos, which was a bust. It was right in the middle of the savings and loan scandal where all real estate was suspect. And I know now the headline's going to be Donald Trump caused the savings and loan scandal. But, you know, it's easy to second guess when the atmosphere back then is not the same as it is today. And I just think that's unfair.
Kevin, I rarely, if ever, defend Donald Trump. But I do have to say that with the casinos, the common belief is that he lent his name to it, but had very little to do with the day-to-day operations, that they just pretty much bought his name to put on the casinos. So I almost, okay. I have to say, I can't really fault him for it. It was just him fronting him. He wasn't running them.
Well, I know that he had something to do with it. And that was the biggest bust gamble for casino gambling ever was Atlantic City. And
yeah.
He's in there somewhere. So
All right.
It's
thanks.
Just, you know, hindsight's 20/20. But, you know, back then I still remember a lot of chaos in the market. So
But you're proving the point in many ways, because that's what the reporting is showing, that he's presenting himself as a great businessman. And he was losing money. I mean, like a lot of other businessmen during that time.
Right, but he was still investing, and he had a bad stretch there. What can you say? I'm just saying, you know, he made it back, and he's successful. I'm not, you know, I don't care one way or another, but it's easy to look back on 30 years and second-guess everything.
May I ask you, did you vote for him, Kevin?
Yes, I did.
All right. I'm just curious, and I want to have a conversation. And
can I ask, though, Kevin, will you vote for him again?
It all depends who's going against him. You know, I think he's done a good job. You know, I just think that, you know, all politics begin at home, and I think Illinois Democrats are the worst. So I'll never vote for a Democrat again, no matter who it is.
See, I hate the fact that we do that, you know. We don't like what the Democrats are doing, so we just automatically have to go Republican. It's frustrating to me. How about going for the best person?
Well, it was between him and Hillary last time. You know, who knows what the best person is going to be.
But you would, regardless of who the best person is, if they're a Democrat, you wouldn't vote for them.
I would never vote another Democrat ever again.
All right,
Kevin.
Just
we appreciate
my reps. I got a know nothing guy, Bob Reed, at the one, and I got Bobby Rush as my congressman, and he doesn't even know where Oak Forest is. So, you know, I don't have a lot of track record back in the Democrats.
All right.
Well, we appreciate your opinion.
I know, and I appreciate you guys too. So get off politics and be funny again. Right. Get off politics.
I'm so please. With you.
All right. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you, Kevin. And we do try to stay away from politics. We try to let people escape from what's going on, but when it's in the news, sometimes you have to bring it up.
So true. So true. All right. We'll take a break. We'll get you some news, and then there's a lot more show ahead. Stick around. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Thank you, Steve. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. Can I just tell you that I've been intrigued by twins ever since I was a little girl?
Really?
I was a tomboy in our neighborhood, a bunch of kids, mainly guys I played with, and a set of twins, Steve and Eric.
Yeah.
Identical twins.
Yeah.
People had trouble telling them apart, but as you got to know them, even though they looked identical,
you could tell somehow.
You just get used to it. I've heard of parents having twins and they put a little Sharpie mark on the bottom of the heel to keep them separated.
Sure. I did that on my kids and I didn't have twins.
So we're going to talk about this twin project that's going on. Jennifer Tackett joins us right now, co-principal investigator of the Illinois Twins Project, ITP. It's happening at Northwestern University. You're a director of clinical psychology at Northwestern University as well. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I am so unbelievably intrigued by twins, and it just so happens, Bill, you have twins, but not identical.
No, they're fraternal. Although I think sororal because they're two girls, but I don't know. I could be wrong. Jennifer, what is your goal here? What are you hoping to learn from this study of twins?
Well, we find twins intriguing as well as you. So the Twin Registry is really designed to answer a wide range of scientific questions. So scientists know that twins are useful in understanding how genes and environments kind of work together to produce basically who we are as people and who we become.
Should we be amazed that two entities that are conceived at the exact same time and are born at pretty much the exact same time, that they can branch off into two such incredibly different people? Should that amaze us, or should we not be amazed by that?
I mean, I find it all amazing, but I'm a little biased. You know, I'm starting a twin registry, so
yeah.
You can guess what I think. Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the most fascinating things about it as a personality researcher. That's exactly what I'm interested in, is what makes people so unique. It's just a fascinating scientific question.
I don't want to, you know, dilute this by going into triplets, but what was that documentary, Three Identical Strangers or something?
Mm. Yeah.
First of all, if you haven't seen that, listeners, please take a moment to watch it. It's amazing. Three brothers, identical triplets, separated at birth. They meet up later on, and they all have almost the same mannerisms. Jennifer, we have learned that an identical twin is one egg that splits either into two or three, making a triplet or a twin. And if two eggs come down the fallopian tube and are fertilized, those are fraternal twins, correct?
Correct, yep.
And I know that identical twins sometimes have like a language of their own, which I remember from growing up with Steve and Eric. They really had their own little language. Do fraternal twins, did your twins have that, Bill?
To some extent, not much. I've seen it play out much more dramatically. But what are your findings about that, Jennifer? What did you guys come up with?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is one of the cool things about twin studies is that science actually supports this idea of twin ease or twindar. So the extent to which twins, they have this eerie inner sense of what the other is thinking, and they finish each other's sentences, and there's actually scientific research that supports that.
What do you think is causing that? There must be some theory as to how that could possibly be, because most people don't have anything close to that. What's going on there?
Well, there's certainly some aspect of, you know, identical twins share all of their genes in common, right? So
yeah.
You can imagine it's probably much easier to anticipate someone when they're much more similar to you. You know, they kind of perceive things the same way and they react the same way. But it's also the case that twins spend a lot of time together for the most part, and so that familiarity is going to play a part as well.
All right, the Illinois Twins Project is what we're talking about. Northwestern University and University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign have partnered to launch this first ever such database in the state. Now, if someone's listening and maybe they're pregnant with twins or they have twins, tell us the age restrictions and why someone would want to contribute to this database.
Sure. So the Twin Registry is meant to be a statewide resource. So twins are really, really valuable for us to study when we're interested in understanding human behavior. And Daniel and I are particularly interested in looking at kids and teenagers for a variety of reasons. And by signing up to be in the registry, it's really a research database. So families aren't committing to participate in any study, but once they're in the database, as faculty members, including our affiliates at across both universities, as they design studies, families may be contacted and then have an option, right, to decide, do I want to be in this study, do I not? They can be in as many studies as they want, or they can be in no studies at all.
Is there a lot of poking and prodding?
It depends on the study.
All right.
You know, some of our faculty, so the kind of work I do know, I'm, you know, studying leadership emergence in kids. So I'm interested in other things that don't involve poking. But
right.
Some of our faculty affiliates look at circadian rhythms and all sorts of things.
Are you finding a huge difference between identical twins and fraternal twins, or not that much of a difference?
Well, that difference is exactly what we capitalize on in these scientific studies, right? So by comparing monozygotic or identical twins who share 100% of their genetic material to dizygotic or fraternal twins who share about 50%, the extent to which they're similar or different, that's how we get our information about the role that genes and environment are playing.
Director of Clinical Psychology at Northwestern University, Jennifer Tackett, is with us, and we're talking about this Illinois Twins Project that she is the co-principal investigator on. You had mentioned leadership a while back. Do you find that there's a dominant twin, or have you?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. So there have been a lot of studies looking at, even beyond twins, but looking at things like birth order, as well as twins. And the best scientific answer to that question is, yes, there's a small effect, but it tends to be very small. So there's a little bit of a sort of dominant, and you also see this in birth order. There's a little bit of this sort of leadership thing that happens with firstborns.
And there could
small.
Be a firstborn twin. I mean,
sure.
Granted, only by
exactly.
a minute.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's how ours are. Yeah.
That's
1 minute
wild
difference.
To me.
Jennifer,
twins are very invested in that, right?
Oh yeah.
If you ask twins who was born first, they know,
right?
And by how much?
Right. Yeah. All right. Before we knew, my wife and I knew that we were having twins. I remembered back to all the twins I knew as a kid, and they were always kind of lumped together as almost one. Anytime they were mentioned, it was the Caldwell twins or the Dotson, always, right? So my wife and I didn't want that, but tell me about that. What happens psychologically to a person who is their own person, but almost always lumped together with their brother or sister? What's that like?
That's interesting. So, one thing that we do see twin development is what we would call contrast effects, where you will see this process over time of twins trying to individualize, right?
Yeah.
Because, right, that's a really powerful force. And it's interesting because you see that effect more strongly in same-sex twin pairs, than in opposite sex twin pairs, presumably because when you have a girl boy twin pair, they're already pretty different,
sure,
right? So they don't feel that pressure. So you absolutely do see these kind of contrast effects emerging across child and especially adolescent development.
I mean, think about it. Your daughters are twins, but if you didn't tell people, no one would know.
They didn't even look like sisters.
And most fraternal twins are like that, especially if, like you mentioned, there's a boy or a girl. But when you have identical twins, I mean, come on. We all remember that Double Mint commercial,
sure,
that Double Mint gum, and
yeah,
they have like twin conferences all over the place.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Yeah.
And it must be hard because I bet a lot of parents dress their identical twins identically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you have really interesting cases like the Olsen twins, Mary-Kate and Ashley.
Yeah.
Olsen, who are actually fraternal twins.
They are?
But they look identical.
Oh, my God.
Right.
Yeah.
I never knew that.
So would you recommend, based on what you know, would you recommend, as Wendy just said, dressing them alike or naming them Andy and Randy? Or, you know, you always see twins where they go, yeah, our names rhyme. Isn't that great? And I always go, yeah. Is that a good idea or a bad idea?
You know, I don't think that it's going to make a huge difference. It certainly may provoke a little bit of this individuation process we're talking about. But they're probably going to be who they're going to be for the most part, regardless.
Right? I would think, yeah.
All right, Jennifer Tackett is on with us. Somebody has texted, is the study interested in twins that are also triplets? We have triplets, identical boys, and then a girl.
Mm.
So they had two eggs come down, one split in two. So are you interested in that?
Absolutely, yeah. So all multiples, we would love to have all multiples register for
Excellent.
The database.
Give that information again, Jennifer, on how people can get involved.
So we have a website. It's iltwins.com, so mm-hmm. IllinoisTwins.com. And people can go on and read more about the researchers who are involved and the kinds of things that we're interested in across both universities. And then there's also a form there that they can sign up.
If you have any questions or comments for Jennifer Tackett, give us a call or a text. We're at 312-981-7200. We've got more coming up in just a minute. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
All right, back to twin speak, a twin spin. Hey, it's a two for Tuesday. No, it's Wednesday. Darn it.
Yeah.
Jennifer Tackett on the line with us, Director of Clinical Psychology at Northwestern University. She's also a co-principal investigator of the Illinois Twins Project. And you can go to iltwins.com to find out more information. Where were we headed on this?
Well, I wanted to ask this question. I know there have been other twin studies, Jennifer. The Texas Twin Project is famous. There's another one on the West Coast. But the one that fascinates me is the one that has to do with Mark Kelly. He's the astronaut. He's the husband of Gabby Gifford, who has a twin brother, Scott Kelly. And what they did was, I'm sure you know way more about this than me, they sent one of them off into space for a while and then brought him back down. And then they're comparing the changes in the bodies of he and his twin brother. Do you know anything about that?
I do. I agree. I think it's so fascinating. I was actually living in Houston when NASA put out the call for that study before it started. And I remember just salivating, like, wow, what an incredible opportunity to study these identical twins. And one of the faculty affiliates at Northwestern on the ITP, the Illinois Twin Project, was involved in that study. So he was he studied the circadian rhythms, the impact on the circadian rhythms that changed when, based on being in space. So the findings are just coming out from that study. They seem to suggest that there are effects of being in space
yeah.
on gene expression, but that a lot of them seem to kind of return to baseline once you're back on Earth, which is fascinating.
Yeah,
that is pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right. So the Illinois Twins Project, although correct me if I'm wrong, Jennifer, but triplets can also be part of this study?
Absolutely. Even if you have more than three. We'll take them off.
847 has just texted us, and this is really fascinating to me. I'm signing up my triplets now, FYI. Their placement in the womb, too low and fighting for position, and the third was up high. And this has been their personalities and interactions with each other for over 15 years. That makes total
sure,
sense.
It does, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. I have goosebumps. This is like really cool. Someone else wants to know, this is a great question. With identical twins, would everything be exactly the same on a 23andMe or an Ancestry type of DNA test?
Great question. Do you know the answer to that, Jennifer?
That is a great question. The answer is no. So certainly there are different reasons why there might be differences in the genetic code. And there, as we were talking about with the Kelly twins, the astronaut, there are certainly differences in gene expression. So even when genetic code is identical, the extent to which the genes are expressed can still be different between monozygotic twins. So they're identical, but they're not totally, completely, at all times identical. Hmm.
That would also explain why identical twins, one could be gay and one could be hetero, correct?
Sure. There are a lot of differences between identical twins. I mean, one of the questions, though, is, you know, what sort of shapes those differences? Like, is that more something that they have unique experiences in the world, or, you know, one twin is in a traumatic accident and the other isn't? Those are the sorts of questions we're interested in.
Are you finding that there are any differences between twins that come about through fertility and those that come about more naturally?
No, and that, it's a good question. I don't know of research that's looked at it specifically, but certainly twins that arise from fertility efforts are more likely to be dizygotic or fraternal. So you see an increased rate of dizygotic twins when there's sort of external intervention.
Because multiple eggs are put in the womb at one time,
yeah,
as opposed to...
That's right.
And some of them could actually split, though, correct? Or no, that would have happened... prior to being put in the uterus?
Well, it could, but based on, like you're saying, the way that the interventions typically occur, it increases the chance that you'll have multiple eggs fertilized at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So the chance of fraternals are just a lot higher.
Jennifer, how often have you heard a version of this story where one twin will tell you that they burn their hand and the other twin is 1,000 miles away, but they feel a pain in their hand? You've heard versions of that, right?
Definitely. Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I think it may relate to what we were talking about earlier with that twin-dar idea. So you hear a lot of stories of that, this extra sensory level of connection between particularly identical twins.
How does science?
They're really fascinating stories.
Does science have any kind of an answer for that? Because it seems otherworldly. How does science write that off?
There's not a great scientific answer for it, but there is scientific evidence that it does seem to exist, right? It doesn't seem to be an anecdote.
I hate to toot my mother horn, but a lot of mothers have that thing, too. It's some kind of intuition, or I don't know how to explain it, but a lot of times, you know, if you get this bad feeling and then you get bad news that your kid was injured.
Right.
I wonder... If there's any connection. One other thing, Jennifer, before we let you go, and Bill, this concerns you, but this might be something you put into your study. These great questions from the listeners. Bill, is your firstborn a left-hander? I'm eldest fraternal and left-handed. I have never met a left-handed second-born fraternal twin.
Kylie, our firstborn, is right-handed. Reese, a minute later, is left-handed.
Well, that is fat. See, you've cracked the code.
Yeah.
How about that?
Interesting.
That is so. I'm intrigued by this whole thing. I really wish I was a twin, although I'm too old. There is an age limit, right? What ages are you looking for?
Ages 17 and under. So anyone falling in child adolescent range.
Will you please keep in touch with us and we can keep up to date on all these fascinating findings because it's very intriguing to us.
I would love that. I really appreciate the chance to chat with you all.
Again, Jennifer, thanks.
The website. Sorry, Bill. The website is iltwins.com, illinoistwins.com, to find out more information. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Thanks,
yeah.
Jennifer. Have a good rest of the week.
Thank you so much.
That's Jennifer Tackett, Director of Clinical Psychology at Northwestern University.
That is so cool.
Yeah. Coming up, the stories that matter with Steve Bertrand from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN Radio. Thank you, Steve. It's Bill Laff, it's Wendy Snyder, and every other Wednesday, our friend Dane Neal, the host of On the Road with Dane Neal, stops by, and we talk about the world of food. This is that every other Wednesday. Hello, Dane.
And the world of food really is just representative of Chicago and the greater metropolitan area.
Yes.
Around Chicago.
That's so true.
Excited. You know, when it comes to the whole food situation, there was a time, 10, 15 years ago when I was doing some of the stuff and syndicated stuff where you had maybe a Charlie Trotter's or a Frontier. Those were the conversation starters. Now the landscape is big. Mm-hmm. So many great restaurants, so many stars of the restaurant world, so many great places. But a lot of them aren't necessarily the ones that you'd think about that are in all these diverse, awesome, delicious neighborhoods. And so it was great to have Sue Park come in. She, of course, you know her from the Fab Food Chicago. That's her thing. She's one of the top Zagat 100 Instagrammers in the country and a new author of Chicago Food Crawls. So you think about these crawls that you can do, where you can get out and kind of take things in a bite-sized, no pun intended way, and do it. And she's got 18 different neighborhoods, kind of broken down the places you should go and check them all out, of course, but maybe some of the ones you should try first. Sue Park.
Sue, congratulations. I know this is your first book. I know that that must be an amazing feeling to hold something you've created in your hand like this.
Yes, thank you.
For people who are unaware of what that term means, I like to think most of us know, but a food crawl qualifies as what exactly?
So, yes, the book is the ultimate food guide through the city neighborhoods. So whether you're living in Chicago or you're visiting Chicago, it's just a fun way to explore through the crawls. And it's just kind of like going into a neighborhood, stopping in a restaurant for brunch, mm-hmm. and then going to another restaurant, grabbing a drink, maybe stop by another restaurant for dinner. So mm-hmm. it's just trying different foods in different neighborhoods.
It's not an organized thing. You do this on your own, correct?
Yes.
All right. I like that idea.
So ideally, would this encompass, is there a limit? Is there a minimum and a maximum as to how many restaurants or pubs or eateries this would include? What's ideal?
No, there's about like 3 to 10 restaurants in each neighborhood.
Yeah.
And I don't think you can fully go and eat at 10 restaurants.
You'd be surprised.
That's a challenge.
I could shock you.
So it's like a loose food crawl. You may come back to the neighborhood and try different restaurants,
yeah.
but you don't have to do it all in one day.
Right. How'd you come up with this idea to make this into a book?
So actually the publisher has a series. So this is a third city in the series.
There's one in Boston, and then also in New York?
New York.
Oh. And so it's, I think, high praise, right, to be, okay, we've got to go ahead and document this. But this is still, quite an undertaking to do justice to the food scene in all those great neighborhoods. I mean, it had to be a lot of work.
It was a lot of work.
Right. But how pleasant would
delicious
it be?
Work.
Oh, Wendy and I are looking through the pictures in this book. We want to jump into the photographs.
Yeah, there's about like over 150 restaurants in there. So
yeah.
I did go and dine at each restaurant.
Twice.
Tough, you tough poor
work.
Baby.
This is awful.
It is hard.
Well, it turns into work. I just want to tell you how beautiful this book is to look at. The cover, the pictures of food could not be any better.
And Sue, is that part of kind of how you get that street cred as one of the 100 top Instagrammers? Instagram is really kind of the medium of choice when it comes to pictures, photography, food. Because, you took, I think, almost all of these photographs in here. You took yourself.
Yeah, I took about 95% of the photos in there, and food is all about visuals, so mm-hmm. It was important to have really great pictures in there.
How did you make the selections, or did, well, I don't know if it was up to you or not, Sue, but how was it chosen as to which places would be included in the book?
So I was able to choose all the restaurants that were in there. I've lived in Chicago all my life since I was 3 years old, so there are some of my favorite restaurants that I go to. Also, it was a year process to do this, so I wanted to include some of the mom and pop restaurants that I go to as well. There's a big range. So you have mom and pop restaurants to Alinea. But it was just some of my favorite restaurants that I wanted to go to.
When you decided to do this, what was the number one? You go, I'm going to write this book about food crawls, so I have to go to where?
I wanted to go to Pilsen.
Yeah.
Because I don't really get out there very much.
Oh, is that where the taco crawl is? Because I want to go there.
There is a taco crawl
so
in there. Because, in Pilsen, we do have, the new restaurants that are popping up there. But I did want to honor the Mexican restaurants that have been there for 20-plus years.
Mm-hmm. It's one of those that's kind of, on that radar screen is one of those cool places to go and a lot of the great spots in there. But you had 20 neighborhoods that you chose to feature that you did stuff for. The publisher kind of cut it back to 18. So even as dialed in as you are to the food scene, there had to be some that were less less familiar than that. So talk a little bit about some of the different, you mentioned Evanston, and unfortunately Bill Hecky's is not, didn't make it this year.
But
what were some of the other ones that may not be as front of mind as, let's say, a Pilsen?
Yeah, so there is one suburb, which is Evanston. Mm-hmm. I think the suburbs gets a bad rep of having chain restaurants and stuff, but I wanted to include Evanston. The dining scene is so vibrant there.
Yes, it is.
And it's so close to the city.
Yeah. What were some of the places in Evanston you chose?
Have you been to Hewn?
No. It's what is that?
It's a bakery, and they make hand-forged artisan bread.
Yeah.
And it's amazing there. Nakorn.
I know that one.
Yeah. Smiley Brothers.
Yep. Go there all the time. That's a brewery that feels like when you're in there, you feel like you're in Colorado. Everything about it has a big mountain, airy space. The food does. The atmosphere does.
Lumberjacks.
A lot of Broncos fans for some weird reason. But I always feel like I'm in Colorado when I'm there.
And the story is great. I mean, it is opened by five brothers.
Yeah.
Their dad was from Texas, so that's why they have barbecue food.
Yeah.
And in the book, that was what was important to me as well, showcasing the food, but also telling the stories of the people behind it.
So you bring up the pictures, and it is a beautiful book to look at. But that is one of the things that I thought was really great. It's something that I've always looked to do or thought was kind of compelling as far as the stories. It isn't just a list of restaurants and maybe a list of dishes and maybe some pictures. Is you do really get into the kind of the backstory, kind of like that great journey. And they're so diverse, you know, all the different stories of who they are, you know, the background, how they got into this. But I think it's important to give people that full scope.
Yeah, because you have so many choices as far as like which restaurants you want to go to, and I feel like you have a deeper connections if you know the story behind the restaurants.
Yep.
All right, I found a tip on page 9 in Bridgeport. There's a secret menu item, and we have talked about the In-N-Out burger. I finally had one for the first time last year. I gotta be honest with you, I wasn't that impressed.
Oh, wow. No.
But there is like a version, Chicago's version of an In-N-Out burger.
Yeah, it's called Up and Over, and it's at the Duck Inn.
Literally.
It looks so much better. Look at that thing.
It's in delicious. Bridgeport. Where, Sue, in Bridgeport?
The Duck Inn.
The Duck Inn, yeah.
Yeah, so there's a lot of tips, insider tips, secret menu items, specials that you'll find in the crawl.
With the secret menu items, a lot of times a restaurant will have a dish that they'll have maybe as a special or for a limited time. But if you go there and you know about it and you ask and they can accommodate you, they'll go out of their way to make sure
that. Yeah, these are dishes that are not on the menu and you ask for.
Yeah, yeah.
You feel kind of special when you get to ask for it, too.
Yeah. Yes.
Like you're into espionage.
The book is called Chicago Food Crawl. Sue Park is the author. We'll continue this conversation in just a moment.
And the segment with Dane Neal is sponsored by Resurrection University. Dane Neal's in the studio. We're also talking with Sue Park, who has her first book. It's a gorgeous one, Chicago Food Crawls.
People want a sequel, Sue. I'm already hearing word on the street. They want more.
I was thinking about that, Bill. As you go to places you can only fit, they cut a couple neighborhoods out.
Yep.
Have you already started thinking? Of course, it's crazy to think of, right? It's just going, maybe a follow-up, mm-hmm. A sequel.
You know, after I wrote this book, I took a break. I didn't want to eat. I didn't want to write anything. I didn't want to take any photos.
Yeah.
But I'm fully out of my food coma now. But
when you would do this, Sue, would you go and eat at these various restaurants and then write about it right away? Or did you wait a day or two? How did that play out?
So all these places I've been to before, but I did write about it right away so
did
I could
you?
Remember it.
Yeah.
But there were times that I had to go to 5 to 6 restaurants in one day.
Wow.
So I did have to write it right.
So it's like which one had the crayons with the kiddie menu.
Yeah, I mean, my memory is not that great anymore, so I did have to write down everything.
Where can we find this book, Chicago Food Crawls?
You can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble's, Target, IndieBound, Books A Million, and some local bookstores.
There's a bonus crawl in here that I just found that I'm excited about.
There's several bonus crawls.
Ah. This is a Logan Square bar crawl.
Yes, there's a bar crawl.
Oh, yummy, yummy.
Are there any places out there that are doing where it's great to have a great either a beer or a cocktail with your dinner, but there are maybe destinations, you know, specifically for the cocktails? That's where you should go and maybe get a couple bites to complement the drink.
Yeah, so Arbea in River North, they have really, really creative drinks, and it's based on drinks from all over the world.
Oh, that's cool.
And their food is really good as well.
Is it good for a restaurant when other restaurants pop up across the street or down the block a little bit? It brings more life to the area, doesn't it?
It does. It definitely does.
So more times than not, it's going to be a competition, but a friendly competition.
Exactly.
They want their neighbors to do well, don't they? It's good for them.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
It was part of it too, because I think there's a couple things that happen here. In some, you're kind of shining a light of appreciation and recognition on places that maybe don't get a lot of attention. But then you've got places like West Loop, right, which are sort of everybody goes in pilgrimage, but it may be a nice way to bird dog an opportunity to make the most out of your stay, you know, because they're all different and they're all relatively expensive, and you can use the book as kind of a guidebook of what to do maybe first.
Right, exactly. And like, you get to choose, you know, based on like what you want to spend and what kind of vibe you want. So there are different restaurants in each neighborhood. And everyone knows West Loop is great for restaurants,
mm-hmm.
but as an Instagrammer, I had to include a dessert crawl in there in the West Loop that's very Instagrammable, so you'll have ice cream and cookies.
and we always think about, you know, rating whether it's like the food or the appearance or the ambiance,
sure.
or the quality, whatever. And you've got a vibometer. You mentioned it's assessing the vibe. What is it? How big is it? Does it fit in a suitcase? Is it a handheld device? The vibometer. What is it?
Exactly.
Another bonus crawl I found should Chicago favorites, the original Maxwell Street, Polish, yum, Garrett's Popcorn Shop, Johnny's Beef, Portillo's Hot Dogs, Gene and Jude's, Lou Malnati's. For you, a chapter, Bill?
Yeah.
Or a little blurb, hottest donuts in town.
Oh. What were the best of the donuts?
So I love donuts, and I had to include the donuts.
Yeah.
But, you know, I love fire cakes. Stand. There's a small donut shop in Uptown called Uptown Donuts, mm-hmm. and they make really,
it's appropriate.
Really great, mm-hmm. Uptown Donuts in Uptown, and they make really great donuts. But the bonus crawls are based on foods I love to eat. So there's sushi, there's donuts, there's pizza, because Chicago's not all about the deep dish pizza,
right?
You know, Spaca is one of my
Spacanopoli. Yeah.
There was a group that was doing a donut tour. I'm sorry, a pizza tour of Chicago recently, where they would take you. Part of the deal was, you went to five or six different classic Chicago pizza places. It seems like a lot to eat, but what would be better than that in Chicago?
And a piece at each place? You could do that.
Yeah, that's doable, right?
Part of I think, having this reputation that's out there now of Chicago as a world-class food destination, we still have a lot of those kind of preconceived notions on whether it's the pizza side or the hot dog side.
Right, right.
And you constantly have it. You know, people are like, oh, the deep dish, that's... It's not that's what everybody, we have everything.
Yeah,
we have everything. Pub style, you've got like the, you know, the wood fired, you've got the Neapolitan pizza, you got everything, and everything done at a really high level. It's just but it's tough, right? Because you want to embrace the Lou Malnati's. There's nothing wrong with it. It's awesome. But we have everything.
Yeah, it's a world class food city, isn't it? Wouldn't you agree?
It is.
I am starving. Just
you should
looking
do
through
a
this.
Scratch and sniff version of this book with several billion copies.
Better than the Vibe of Meter.
Dane, I have to ask you, we just had the Beard Awards. They ended in controversy when one of the restaurateurs blocked another one around the last turn, so they had to do a photo finish. The Beard Awards were very exciting this year, weren't they?
For the listeners, too, Scott Miller, this is not related to the awards that he's usually trying to nominate himself for, if you remember him from Famous Beards. Yes, of course, and this is another, I think, testament to just that progression of Chicago on the recognition side as a great food city, is the James Beard Foundation Awards happened here in Chicago. We've had them. This is, I think, the fifth year, and I think they've signed up for another 7 years after that. So, so this will be the place that the entire food world, and literally the world, converges for what is recognized and is truly the Oscars of food. And so you'll see, you know, a number of your, whether it's like famous TV chefs and personalities and mover shakers and industry leaders, and a lot of those great chefs coming into you know, kind of receive those awards. And Chicago, well represented again. It was nice to see Kevin Bang and Rob Cass from the Boca Group getting their recognition. What I love about Publican Quality Bread, right? They ended up winning as well, been nominated a few times. So there's a great Chicago, not only representation in the audience and the crowd as the nominees, but also for the awards. And you see these different stories. What I love about it is one of those few events where you really get to witness firsthand, you know, someone achieving what is the top in their career, whether it's the Oscars or some of these other awards, and just that, you know, just like visually and through their speech and through those testimonials, like what it's like to really get there. And so it's a great moment. A lot of recognition for all those chefs and places and the American classics too. So you've got just some mom and pop places getting recognized, and it really does run the gamut from, like I said, small mom and pop places that have been doing things, you know, out in maybe a rural setting for the last 50, 60 years to those hottest, you know, kind of greatest restaurants that are kind of on the cutting
edge. It's so good that we have them. They were in New York for years and years and years, and we kind of stole them away.
Yeah, they still have the media awards there, so they'll still do the cookbook awards, and some of the journalism stuff still happens in New York, and that's where the foundation is based out of. But for here at the Lyric, it's great. There's talk it may move venues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's consistently sold out. But I thought it was really great. This is the first time that I had watched it from start to finish, as opposed to just in the press room.
Right.
And it was, as award shows go, which, you know, without a dance number and, you know, without a music act.
Right.
It was compelling. There's some really great stuff.
Excellent. Sue Park's book is called Chicago Food Crawls. As she mentioned, it's available at Barnes & Noble, Amazon,
Target,
wherever books are sold.
Congrats.
Yeah, congrats.
So
it's a great book, Sue. Dane, great to see you. Thanks for coming
by.
Good
to see you guys. Thanks.
We'll take a break. We'll get you some news, and then more of Us, Bill and Wendy on WGN. Eric, thanks very much.
Thank you, Eric. You're doing a great job.
Isn't Eric Rung doing
a nice job?
I like Eric Rung a lot.
I like watching you on the WGN TV news as well.
Thanks, guys. You guys make me feel special.
I like watching you on SVU.
Did you just recently get a haircut? Because I noticed one of your live shots on WGN TV, you looked freshly coiffed.
I did, yes.
See?
It was last week I got one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I see you a lot.
Oh.
I was in desperate need for one. My hair was... I do enjoy the curls, but they were out of control.
Did you look like... Eric, my mom used to have a word, a ragamuffin. Did you look like a ragamuffin?
I would say at 9 o'clock last week for one of my live shots, yes, ragamuffin.
Ragamuffin.
Yes.
He didn't look like a ragamuffin.
You never know, Wendy.
He didn't look anything like you when your mom called you a ragamuffin.
Thank you. Here's a... All right. I have to preface this by saying that everyone on the planet watches and loves Game of Thrones, except for you and me.
I've not seen one lick of it.
Oh, you can count me in on that.
Oh, you're not in on it either.
Jasmine watches it.
Jasmine,
I know she represents for our show.
And the frustration sometimes in the morning when I get in, Steve Bertrand will come by and Jasmine's there in the office and they want so badly to discuss what they've just seen on Game of Thrones, but it
you care not.
I don't know. Well, it's not that I don't care. It's just I feel I'm so...
Left out?
I've never seen... Yeah. I
will never watch it.
Oh, I know I will.
Well, what are you waiting for?
Well, I don't know. Somebody said, like, when this season... Prior to this season starting, somebody said, you know, if you started now, you could catch up. And then you can watch the last season in
time. That's the way to do it.
But... the commitment was too great. I'm going to start it this summer. I don't know that
after
I'll finish
everything
it.
Is spoiled.
Well,
everything.
I'm doing my best to stay away. Anytime I see anything online that has anything to do with it, I divert my attention. I look the other way. I don't want to know what it is.
But everybody in the world except us is talking about it, so you'd need to be in a coma to avoid anything.
I'm going to be in a self-induced coma one day. I just
decided. A Game of Thrones-induced coma.
Right, right. Now, because of your lack of interest and my lack of interest in all things having to do with Game of Thrones, there was a huge story a couple of days ago that in the last episode of Game of Thrones... Now, I'm not even going to say spoiler alert because I'm not spoiling anything here, I don't think. I think everybody knows this. Somehow, there was a Starbucks cup in a pivotal scene. And
what's wrong with that?
Well, apparently Starbucks wasn't the coffee force back then during Game of Thrones time that it is now. So some people said, well, that took me out of the moment. I was watching Game of Thrones and I was, I was so into it. And then I looked at and there was a cup from
Starbucks.
It does
look weird. It's just sitting there.
Right, right. So people try to explain then how that could come to be. And the answer that most people seem satisfied with was that one of the tech people working on the show must have been working on something in the scene and just left the cup there. And then all of a sudden they were back to shooting and the cup was in the scene. But what you had there was a major gaffe.
But wouldn't you notice the gaffe before it went to final...
That's,
showing?
Many people have said versions of that. Is there's so many people, you know, in any movie or TV show, there's a department called continuity, and it's their job to make sure that things match up and that nothing's out of place. And for some reason, this one went by. No one noticed this.
It seems odd.
Well,
I think it was intentional. Someone got a stipend from product Starbucks. Placement. Yeah.
You think there's some product placement going on there? All right. So I have found, this is on Variety's website. These are other such gaffes, or what they call anachronisms, things that have happened on movies or TV shows that were either historically incorrect or something like that, you know, that it was just out of place.
Or just wrong.
Or just wrong, right. You know, you've seen the movie Braveheart.
Yes.
Right? You'll notice that through scenes in Braveheart, some of the men are wearing kilts.
Yeah.
And you readily accepted that, right? You went, yeah, well, yeah. At the time, I guess a guy would be wearing a kilt, right? You'd be incorrect. It says, the plaid and tartan of kilts weren't introduced until the 1700s, making that historically inaccurate, that people during the years that Braveheart took place could not be wearing traditional Scottish kilts.
Maybe this was a rogue group of kilt wearers.
Like forerunners to the kilt trend?
Yeah, before that, yeah.
Possibly.
Who has that much time? Well, I shouldn't ask that because you have that much time. You cannot watch a movie. What was it? Gravity or something? What movie was it that you couldn't watch because you didn't think...
The Martian.
Yes. You didn't think that catapulting something around would happen. And then when we spoke to somebody from the Adler Planetarium, yes, they said, oh, you can totally
you
do
can
that.
You can do that. And I had to write Matt Damon a very apologetic letter because it bothered me. Like, I was liking that movie a lot, and then when that scene happened, I went, oh, this is so fake. They couldn't do anything like that.
But they actually
could.
But
then they said they could do that.
And that ruined the movie, didn't it?
Yeah.
It took you out of...
It did.
You think the Starbucks cup took you out of something?
This did. It even more. This did it even way even more.
You gotta let go, Bill.
Wendy, in the movie The Shawshank Redemption...
Great movie.
That's one of my all-time favorite movies.
Pretty great.
It's one of my favorite movies. The character Andy Dufresne has a poster in his cell of Raquel Welch. However, the poster that he had did not exist. The timeline is 1966 to 1967. Well, it takes place in 1966, but the movie itself that poster is from, A Million Years BC, didn't happen until the next year.
Oh, that's a year. Quit quibbling about a year.
I'm just reading what they've written at Vanity Fair.
Would that bug you? Did that ruin the movie?
No,
now
I've
that
seen
you know?
Shawshank Redemption
100 times.
Not 100, but I've seen it a bunch of times. I just accepted it. I just went, well, he loves his Raquel Welch, and who can fault him for that? I wasn't going, yeah, but if that movie was released. But there have been other times where I've seen things. I'm trying to remember what TV show had some toys, some action figures, and I went, those figures didn't come out for 5 years after
My
that.
My husband does that, too.
Yeah. So
most of us just watch a movie and enjoy it.
I know.
It. Can we talk to Denise really quickly while you're involved in this?
Yes.
Hi, Denise. How are you?
Hi, good. How are you today?
We're great. So you have worked on some shows here in Chicago as an extra. Yes.
So I guess I don't know if I'm a professional extra, but I do quite a bit of extra work on Chicago Med, Chicago Fire, Empire, The Shy.
Wow.
And so just seeing that cup, what I think, you know, they're doing the scene so many different times, and they'll say reset, or you got to go back to the, you know, original. And in between, I'm sure the actor probably had Starbucks sitting off to the side, and while they're, you know, resetting the cameras, he probably had it. And then they're like, okay, reset, we're getting back to shooting. And he just probably set it down, or he or she, and then it ended up on there by accident. But I've also worked on Chicago Med, and you might notice that there's a blue Walmart bag. It's like a shopping bag that sometimes they have the extras like hold it. And I think that's intentional. I think that's product placement.
Really? I've never noticed that. So,
yes.
So that happens in every episode or just every once in a while?
Yeah, I know a lot of movies, like if you'll see a Pepsi can just strategically placed and you notice the logo,
right.
Product placement, they'll pay money in order for that product to be placed in a movie. I'm sure Starbucks did not pay to have that as part of the Game of Thrones, but I think it was just, it was an error. And continuity, too, they'll have the actors, and if you have a drink you go on set, when you get off set, there's a chart where you have to remember your drink number.
Right.
And you set it down on the table. And then when you get called back, you have to grab that exact same drink. And that keeps that continuity.
And Denise, tell everybody, I already know this, but I'm sure you've experienced this. They take 1,000 pictures to make sure that if one of your sleeves is rolled up to the elbow, that it matches. You know, everything has to match. They go out of their way.
Yeah, there definitely is a continuity department. And just one example that happened, and this is how good they are. I worked as an extra on the very first Chicago fire. It was like the burning building, and you know, and everyone, you have wardrobe looks at you before you go on set, you're here. Well, I was outside, it was filmed on Michigan Avenue, and I put my sunglasses on, and there were probably over 200, 300 people working as extras.
Yeah.
And one of the gal wardrobe came up to me and she said, "Did you have those sunglasses on, you know, before?" And I go, "Oh, no, no." You know, I took them off and I put them, you know, my purse. And if you have a purse or a bag, it cannot have any logo on it. I mean, they're really careful about keeping that continuity. So I say it was one of the main actors that's drinking a Starbucks.
Although I'm getting information now from our texters who are very astute. And they said they have come out now and said it was not a Starbucks cup, but a Kraft paper cup. So Starbucks is really getting free advertising here, and it isn't even Starbucks.
Absolutely, and they're probably loving every minute of it, and reposting it, and they're getting a good bang for their buck, which was nothing spent. So,
all right, well, we'll look for you, Denise.
Thanks, Denise.
Oh, okay, great. Thanks, guys.
Appreciate
Keep up the great
it.
Work. Love listening to you.
Thank Alrighty. You.
Thank
Bye.
You.
Let's do this. We'll take a quick break, Wendy. When we come back, more of these mistakes, these errors in TV shows or movies. Have you spotted any? We're at 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
All right, the Starbucks cup that isn't a Starbucks cup, and we just found out from Mike Poe, who does a lot of video production here at WGN, that it has been removed.
I said to him, with all the people involved in continuity, why didn't somebody, if they shot the scene, why didn't they digitally erase it? And he said, that's already been done. Once it was shown originally on Sunday night, that was already too late. But once the outcry came and people said, hey, there's a Starbucks cup in Game of Thrones, they did go back and erase it. So if you're watching it for the first time now, not if you DVR'd it, it's already in locked in, but if you're watching it tonight or tomorrow or the next night, it's going to be gone.
And we weren't sure how this could have made it to final product, but he also explained that a lot of times, you know, you will do several takes,
sure.
And if someone saw that cup, you know, after the take, they'd say, hey, you know what? There's a cup there. It shouldn't have happened.
Right.
So they reshoot it, but then they end up taking the best cut, and maybe that's the one with the cup in it that they kind of forgot about at that point.
Right.
There is so much that goes into a movie and television show. I just like to watch it. I would not want to think about all that.
Well, when you look at the credits when a movie's over, and sometimes the credits are 6 minutes long and everybody's name is a third of an inch tall, you go, wow, 14,000 people worked on this movie. That's amazing.
I try to watch every credit because, I mean, they worked so hard.
Sure. Do you say their names out loud during the credits?
Yes.
Yeah, you're supposed to.
312-981-7200 is our number right now. Let's get a last call in. Joe has called us. Hi, Joe.
Hello? Yeah, hello. It's Joel, not Joe.
Hi, Joel.
Joel, do you have a movie or TV mistake? What'd you see?
Okay, real fast. In the Best Little Whorehouse in Texas with Burt Reynolds and Dolly Parton.
Yes.
It starts out with a yellow pickup truck going down a road with a jukebox in the back. Well, that jukebox was made in 1946, and it lists something in Texas like 1939.
Ah.
So no way that could have been there.
Where?
Historically inaccurate, right?
No, yeah, it was.
Yep.
It was like... they do with cars sometimes, mix up the years. Also, the best one was when Harry met Sally, and they're leaving the University of Chicago to go to New York.
Yeah.
They go through the Oak Street curve. So why would you go north?
Oh, you're going the wrong direction.
When you're going to go the other way.
Wow.
That's great.
That's excellent. Thanks, Joel.
Okay, you're welcome.
I got a couple for you. Wizard of Oz. Have you ever seen The Wizard of Oz, Wendy?
Many times.
Did you notice something funny about Dorothy Gale's hair?
No.
Throughout the movie, her hair gets longer and shorter.
Oh, really?
Her pigtails. Sometimes they're long, then a little bit later they're short, then they're medium, then they're short again, then they're long.
Did you notice that yourself?
I noticed that myself.
I've been really into this new Amsterdam show that is on television. I don't know which network. I got to be honest with you. I'm sorry. I think
NBC, I believe.
It's after The Voice, so yeah. And there was one scene where they show Max, who's the hospital director, and his beard is very like tight, like a Don Johnson-y.
Yeah.
And then in like they cut away from him and they go back to him and it's really kind of fuzzy, and then it goes back to short again, and then later on in the episode the beard is longer again. So they reshot something.
Out of sequence.
Totally noticeable, and yeah. Usually I don't notice anything like that.
Interesting.
It really kind of bugged me.
But it does, right? It takes you out of it.
And this is something that I wonder if Jimmy Mack knows. There's this, you know, the stormtrooper in episode...
The one that bumps his head?
Yeah.
I've seen that scene.
All right, if you know it, I'm sure he knows
that
it.
That one's kind of famous.
He will laugh at me if I say, hey, do you know that a stormtrooper bumped his head? Well, yeah.
I saw a mistake on Windy City Live this week.
The whole show?
Yeah, they aired it. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Steve Bertrand's in with the Wintrust Business Lunch. That's coming up next. Bill and Wendy, WGN.
You proud of yourself?
Yeah.
Coming up, Eric Rung has your news, the stories that matter from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.